All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? How are you? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Thank you for joining. Got up early to do morning radio. I was on Heidi and Frank this morning talking about tonight's episode of Maron on IFC. I might as well talk about it here as well. This is my show. I've been making the rounds at the publicity machine. Was on Midnight the other night. Did Kimmel a couple weeks ago. They repeated that. Like I was Mr. Television Tuesday night. I was on Midnight and a repeat of Jimmy Kimmel. Big night of Maron on two different networks. Huh? And then tonight on my own show on IFC, which I hope you're watching. Tonight's episode is a bit gnarly, funny, deep, a little touching, a bit brutal emotionally. It's actually based on something that never happened. But let me tell you who's on the show here today. Today's Kevin Corrigan. Today I talked to Kevin Corrigan. You all know Kevin Corrigan. He was in Goodfellas, The Departed, Superbad, Pineapple Express, big fan with Patton Oswalt, Community. He's appeared on there. You'd know him. You'd know him if you've seen him. He's been in almost every indie movie made in the last 20 years. I mean, maybe that's a stretch, but he's in a new one that we talk about a bit. I was actually only halfway through the new movie when I talked to Kevin. Didn't get through it, but I was enjoying it. I was sort of immersed in it. I like movies like that. The last guy that sort of compelled me that way in terms of his art, Joe Swanberg, was to me an amazing independent filmmaker. And in this film that I started watching, it's called Results, directed by Andrew Buchalski, who I believe did another film called Computer Chess, which I did not see. But I have not seen his films, but he's clearly a dude with a vision. And I felt that right away when I started watching it. And Corrigan's in it, and he's great in it. Guy Pearce is in it, and he's great in it. And Constance Zimmer, who's on my show as well. But anyways, I was enjoying the film, and I finished it since I talked to Kevin, and I would have told him it was amazing because I really dug it. It was interesting. It was not predictable or hackneyed. It was a kind of lyrical and poetic. It was a real indie film, and I dug it. So there's how I feel about Results, the movie, which should be opening any minute now in theaters in tomorrow, folks. All right. So, anyways, Corrigan's going to be. I'm going to talk to Corrigan in a few minutes. Let's make sure I get to everything I want to tell you. I want to talk about tonight's episode of Maron. I also want to talk about the Rolling Stones concert. I'll tell you what's going on. Tonight, the episode of Maron was a little rough. It was rough for me to make emotionally. This is the episode that I wrote and directed this year. It is about a hypothetical situation. I don't know how I would handle it in reality, but I did write it. The character of Mark Maron has an ex-wife who has written a book. Their ex-wife's name is Michelle. And she was played by Jessica Mackinson, who played her briefly in the first season of the show. And it's basically, you know, we decide or she decides or, you know, collectively sort of decide that, you know, I should have her on the podcast to help her sell her book. Her publicist suggested it. And we think we can handle that. And through the course of, you know, moving through the house, which you'll have to suspend your disbelief as being the original house. There's only been one house in the mind of the show. We had to switch houses set-wise because the first house was no longer available to us. But it's all the same house. It doesn't matter. So it's really about her coming back to the house that we had bought together. And there are flashbacks, which is why I shaved my face and cleaned myself up. But doing this episode and making the episode of Maron that you'll see tonight, I was able to really kind of get a little bit of closure that I didn't think I would ever get. It's interesting. It's a very raw bit of emotional theater here on Maron tonight, and it's very real emotions. And I hope, you know, I'm no Olivier, but I was definitely tapped into this thing. So it's compelling and it's raw. And when I watched it again, I kind of got choked up. There's comedy in it. It's balanced. But Marilyn Rice Cub is also in the episode, as is Dave. Pow! Look out. Just shit my pants, just coffee.coop. Haven't done that in a while. Don't even have to do it, but I did it. Because I was feeling emotional. And I went ahead and stepped on that with a coffee plug, with a slurp and a plug. Slurp and a plug. I push those emotions down. But watch Marin tonight. I'd like to know what you think. It's very personal, and I have a lot invested in it, acting wise, writing wise, and also directing wise. It was a big thrill to direct this episode. Oh God, I'm nervous for it to be on television. Okay, Rolling Stones. Marc Maron, Dean Del Rey, going to the Rolling Stones. Now, you heard Mick Jagger promise me, Marc Maron, on this show to take care of me. Dean comes over on Sunday. We hit the road about 2, and we're kind of jacked. We're early. We're leaving early. It's about 2 to 3 hour run down to San Diego. And I'm like, I'm nervous because, like, I don't like crowds, you know, parking situations and everything. And, you know, he's pretty sure that everything, Dean's like this president, like, nah, dude, it's going to work out great. Everything's going to be great. We're set. We're there like at 5:45. We park, $35, no problem. Like literally a half a block from the stadium. We get out. We go to Will Call. Seems to be a little chaos about where that is. Doesn't look like there are tickets there. And we go to this gate and we're going through and there's some woman with a clipboard. I'm like, yeah, we got media Will Call, media Will Call. She gives us these 2 tickets and we look at the tickets. We don't know what it means, but it's A3, row 11, seats like 9 and 10. I actually remember that. And the price tag on the seat was like $395. We're like, dude, what is this? Where are these? So me and Dean are like, fuck, what do we got? And we go down the field, we go, and we're 11 rows up from the stage in the A3 section, which is just stage right. So it's like right at a perfect angle to see people. We get down there on the field at 6 o'clock. The Stones aren't going on until 9. Gary Clark Jr. is going on at 8. And he's up there, you know, tuning his guitars and shit. And King Zapata, his guitar player, sees me. He's like, what's up, man? I'm like, hey, dude, you excited? He's like, yeah, pretty excited. Then people started coming. And as Dean said, a lot of reading glasses out. Yeah, it was that kind of crowd. You know, people like a little older than me, some my age, but, you know, not a raucous bunch, but a lot of people. But it was, here's the weird thing. It would be very easy for me to condescend to this. And, you know, I am on the younger spectrum of the boomer arc. The last one out of the gate, really. These were people that had a relationship with this band probably their entire life. As I did, but not in the same way. I would imagine that many of these people seen this band a lot. They were probably growing up around the same time as the Stones. They were teenagers, maybe. You know, I came to the Stones always late to the party, but you know, by the time I was, you know, listening to the Rolling Stones, I was in high school, and all their records had been out. So all of a sudden, like, this weird part of my heart is opening to all these people that I would generally find annoying. There's a vanity to the boomers. You know, there's a lot of hair color around. There's a lot of strained ego presentation in the way of attire. A lot of showboats and whatnot. But whatever, we're at the Rolling Stones show. So I was there and I was excited, but I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know how it would feel. I have a weird thing with older people in that I feel like they're fragile. And it reminds me of my own mortality. And it reminds me, I haven't quite put it all together, but I get nervous around elderly people. And I shouldn't, because, you know, that's where it's all at. You know, that's where the wisdom is. That's where the humility is. That's where... you know, hopefully a sense of humor and not darkness and bitterness is. That's where it all ends up, if you're lucky. And I think I'm just awkwardly afraid of the vulnerability that comes with getting old. Inevitably. Inevitably. Because we all fight so hard against that. We just do. It's natural. You know, the one thing America is not known for is aging gracefully. Americans in general. Panic about it. So anyways, a big thing happens on the screen. There's like this film strip, like the career of the Rolling Stones and this groovy fucking, you know, video thing. And then like the lights go down and I just feel myself like I'm sitting there like going, what's this going to be about? And then like the video happens and I'm feeling like an electricity going through my body. I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God, the Rolling Stones. And then it's like they introduce the Rolling Stones. And then I hear I hear Keith just like plunk out the fucking opening chords of Jumping Jack Flash. Gang, gang, boom, boom, bang. And I'm like, yeah! Like, I'm up. Me and Dean are up. We're standing. I'm waving my hands. I'm pointing at the stage with the little beast fingers. You know, I'm doing the whole fucking number. And then Mick comes out, and he's like old Mick, man. He's like, not old Mick, but like young Mick. He's like just bouncing around. He's doing the dance moves. He's doing them like he was fucking 20. Like, well, actually, a little better. He didn't really learn how to dance that well until probably mid-20s. And he's just kicking it. And they're on it. It's the Stones, and it's happening, and they're right in front of me, and I can see them. The screens are going. Ronnie looks great. Charlie's holding steady. Keith is hanging on, just, like, looking good. No, you know, he's taking all the weird dangly shit out of his hair. He's just wearing a headband. Looks respectable, charming, like the fucking devil. And Mick is just jumping around, doing the dance. It was fucking stunning. 71 years old, jumping around. The lights come down. Mick puts on a guitar, and they play Moonlight Mile. They start Moonlight Mile, and Mick fucking hits the notes, the falsetto, beautifully. I start weeping. Dean is like, oh, no, oh, man. And, like, I'm crying while Mick is singing Moonlight Mile, weeping. He sounded perfect. And then you could see the on the big screen his face, and you saw that's Mick Jagger. But within the Mick Jagger head, see, what could easily become sort of tragic is if the age beats out the Mick Jagger. Like if the age consumes how large the Mick Jagger-ness is. And then it was perfectly balanced. There was his face. I could see all the lines of his face, and I could hear the thing that you can't hide when you're old in his voice. But it sounded beautiful. The vulnerability of being Mick Jagger or being anybody at that age was coming through in these songs, and the audience was moved by it. So, like, that one thing that I had prejudged, this idea that they would be too old to do what they do, was completely leveled by the fact that they are doing exactly what they do because they are exactly who they are. And we were all sort of like in it with them. It was beautiful, and it meant a lot to know that they're still putting out this type of show at this age. It was fucking amazing. It was everything. And goddamn, yeah, I want to thank everyone involved for getting me those tickets, for getting me and Dean to have that experience. And no, quite honestly, the playlist on the ride home for some reason was on that 2-hour run. A lot of Grateful Dead. Me and Dean were doing a lot of Grateful Dead. Little Allman Brothers did some Skynyrd and some ZZ Top. And we played it loud on the way down. A lot of AC/DC. And then we enjoyed the Stones in between those two car rides. It was spectacular. Great experience. And they were fucking beyond anything I could have imagined. All right, let's talk to Kevin Corrigan now.
I've gotten into a talk show type thing. I got drafted into it. I was subbing for someone, and then that person never came back.
Oh, yeah. It's like a live talk show.
Yeah.
On stage.
Yeah.
And you talked to David Johansen?
Him and Kim Gordon, as yeah. You did. That's
not easy. Nothing easy about that, Chad. Was there, Kevin?
Oh, well, I ended up, you know, I asked her if I could read some passages from her book, you know, and that that was fun just to...
Oh, that's a good idea.
It was nice. And just to be up there with Kim and David, two generations of
New York rock
and roll, it was hard not to get a little self-conscious about that. I think I...
Did you grow up with it?
Well, you know, I
How old are you?
I'm 46.
Right, so you're close to me. I'm 51.
That's right. Yeah. You interviewed Michael Imperioli not too long ago, so I listened to that.
Are you guys buddies?
Yeah, you know, we met a while back, you know. He worked in a restaurant with my brother.
Oh, yeah?
I think in his interview with you, he called it a wedding hall. It's a restaurant.
Are we going to correct that? There's a minor correction.
It was a very fancy restaurant in Scarsdale. You know, people like Phil Rizzuto would go there. I think Joe DiMaggio was a good friend of Nat's.
Oh, really?
People like that would...
So is that kind of place? So Italian food or what?
Yes, Italian food. Uh-huh. Very, you know, classy place. They would have a carnival. Like when you think fancy restaurant.
That's it.
That was it.
But they did. They must have done events. He had it in his head that it was an event sort of place.
It was definitely like the set of a movie. Uh-huh. So if you know, they would have weddings there.
Maybe he only worked those events primarily.
Yeah, that was their specialty. They would have these what did they call it? The Viennese tables. I guess there was a very brief moment where I was thinking of going to work there also, because the invitation was there, the option was
sure.
There,
and so you wear a white shirt and a bow tie, maybe a red jacket,
a black jacket, Yeah, I think you know, one day going to a school. I went to high school in the Bronx at a place called Mount St. Michael for 2 years, and one day I couldn't find any pants. So I grabbed my brother's tuxedo pants, you know, with the stripe down the side. Someone who I went to school with, who worked with my brother at Alex and Henry, goes, "Hey, you wearing your brother's pants, huh?" Anyway, so Michael worked there,
too. And that became your look.
That became my look sometimes.
Occasionally. I wore a pair of tuxedo pants occasionally.
Yeah.
With the with suspenders. They had suspender buttons, and they were secondhand. I got them at some point. I was doing that.
That's a style.
Sure, I don't know what style it was. Maybe clown, maybe clown was what I was going for. But you didn't take the job there.
No, I'm not a working man. You know?
No, just, never were. Never your thing.
I've never had a job.
How many? Really? So how many siblings do you have?
Just my brother.
And you grew up, you spent your whole childhood in the Bronx.
Yes.
What part?
The last stop on the D train, 206th Street.
What was that neighborhood like?
Diverse neighborhood. I mean, predominantly, I guess, you know, Irish Catholic in the 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty diverse neighborhood.
And you're Irish all the way through?
Irish and Puerto Rican.
Huh.
Yes.
That's not unusual in New York, I don't think, right?
Not as much as I don't know if you would think that was unusual, but I had a friend, one or two buddies that I grew up with who also had, like, my friend Chris Ramos's mom was Irish, and his father was Puerto Rican, so I had that in common with a few people,
yeah.
not too many.
Do you speak Spanish?
I don't, and I did ask my mother why that was when I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
And she said my grandmother didn't really want that for my brother and me. You know, that's just, she didn't even want that from my mother.
Right.
I'm like, but you spoke Spanish. She speaks a lot less Spanish today than she did when I was growing up.
I guess that was to sort of integrate.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
You know, I remember, you know, hearing my mother speak Spanish on the phone.
Uh-huh.
You know, the family was a lot bigger back then. It's kind of, you know, people
tightened up.
People pass on, you know, things change. There was a very lively scene at my grandmother's house in the South Bronx when I was growing up for Christmases and Easters, and, you know, she was very religious. And
that was the Puerto Rican side?
Yes.
So did you get the Irish scene as well? Did you get both sides?
There was a time when everybody would make the rounds, like my Uncle Jack and Aunt Mary would show up at uh-huh. my Uncle Sam's house, so there was there would be a mix, because they all grew up together in the South Bronx in the 50s and 60s.
Your mother's family and your father's family?
Yes.
So you go from... from a very specific, I'd imagine, Puerto Rican Catholic Christmas situation.
Yes.
To a fairly specific Irish Catholic.
We would ping pong. We would just bounce all around.
The food was
town.
Probably better at the Puerto Rican situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a little more flavor. But, I mean, there was something, that both cultures offered, you know.
Yeah? Like what?
Well, you know... Just everybody likes to party, you know.
Yeah, sure,
so,
sure.
It was a very
drunky
kind of culture. Yeah, it had a good, it had its ups and downs.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But that was the neighborhood too, you know. It's just like a lot of partying. You know, I have a good friend, one of my best friends, is from Astoria, Queens.
Yeah, I lived there for a few years.
I know you lived there. Yeah. He lived on Ditmars, right near the train, and his name's George Silidis.
Uh-huh.
So he's Greek, and he's. We would often talk about the differences between Queens and the Bronx, and especially in terms of like drugs and alcohol,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that the Bronx was much more alcohol oriented, whereas Queens was more like codeine and sort of like. Quaaludes.
No kidding.
That kind of head.
I don't know if I never, I know, I don't know if I noticed that. I did notice, like, after I went back to New York, like in 2005 or six, I noticed there were dope heads on the train to Queens. Like I assumed that some of that business must have went elsewhere, that you know, on the Lower East Side doesn't have the heroin it used to. But I saw a few times I would see people looking like they were going to score out there in Ditmars.
Yeah.
Maybe that started where maybe some of that business moved out there. I don't know.
I don't know. I think it was kind of a widespread. My friend, David Krumholtz lived in Forest Hills. And he would just talk about how there was like a sort of a mental institution out there. So there was just like a lot of crazy people on medication.
Everywhere. on the island.
In Queens. Yeah. Whereas the Bronx was a lot more sort of rowdy, a lot more drinking going on there.
Yeah. What did your old man do?
My father is a placement counselor. You know, he's a headhunter. Mm-hmm. He's always worked in Manhattan. He's always worn nice suits. He's always taken me out to get fitted for like a nice suit at Men's Warehouse or Barney's or something. Ties. He has a great collection of really tasteful, nice clothes. Mm. And he worked in an office. He worked in the Daily News building in the early '80s. Yeah. Where they filmed Superman. So you walk into the lobby and it has the big planet.
Yeah.
And my mom is an artist. She went to High School of Art and Design and School of Visual Arts and didn't pursue like a career at it, but never stopped doing it and passed that on to me.
Her medium?
She's a oil painter. She's a sculptor. She's a dressmaker and she can write, and
they're still together?
They're still together, yes.
Isn't that sweet?
It is sweet.
When did you start acting?
When I was 14, I started going to the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute.
Your parents were supportive of the decision to go and take those classes? They wanted you to get involved?
Not right away. They, they told me to wait a while. When I told them I wanted to be an actor, they said, give it a year. So I did, and then I saw...
So that was when you were 13?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What made you want to do it?
Well, I went to see the movie Terms of Endearment.
Yeah.
Kind of knocked me out. I really was kind of like blown away by that movie. Jack Nicholson.
And
Shirley MacLaine, too.
Right.
And I just kind of really fell in love. I was kind of desperate at that point to pursue it. Just because of whatever that movie, that movie made me kind of, that was some experience.
Yeah, it was. It's a real tearjerker.
It is, yeah.
Takes you on a little roller coaster ride.
It does.
Jerks you around.
Yeah, there's a lot of great acting in it, too. John Lithgow, Deborah Winger.
Jeff Daniels.
Jeff Daniels, yeah.
The power of acting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm more of a sort of De Niro Pacino guy, but it was that movie was the...
What do you think it was about it? Just the way you felt? That you were moved?
I guess it was the... I don't know. I've been revisiting a lot of movies. I just watched American Graffiti the other night.
Again.
And just can never get over how great, Richard Dreyfuss is in that movie. And, Mackenzie Phillips.
Yeah.
Paul LaMatte and Candy Clark. Everyone in it. It's just like... They seem so real. There's such a spontaneity in their performances, and it's like that's what it was, an infectious energy, and it's like what John Lennon used to say about songwriting. It takes hearing something by Mick Jagger to make him feel like, oh shit, that makes me want to make a record. When I see someone in a good movie, it makes me want to try to find a job like that.
Sure. So you're provoked by Terms of Endearment to go to Lee Strasberg.
It is. It was a provocation in a way. Yeah, yeah.
And you show up there at 14. How were you received over there?
I think I was never made to feel like I didn't belong there. I was welcome right away. I was just kind of, once I got set loose in that place, it was the place for me to be.
You were the kid?
I became the kid. There was another kid there at the time.
Yeah, what happened to that kid?
He's out of the picture now. I was like, you know, you ain't the kid no more. But it took about a year of...
of out-acting him?
Yeah.
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 Slowly chipping away at his confidence?
Yeah, you know, I stole some of his material, actually.
Oh, did you?
This guy was... maybe he's still acting. He was doing a monologue from The Catcher in the Rye, and I was, like, pretty amazed by... Yeah. The material.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't think he was doing it very well. And I asked
But it was a unique approach to pull a monologue from The Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, maybe not that original. But it didn't make any difference. I mean, I was like, that's that book I was supposed to read in my freshman year of high school, and I didn't. So I reread it, and I was like, I started doing the same thing that this guy was doing, only better.
Right. What was the training at that point? I mean, at Lee Strasberg. I mean, what you were just, you would work with a teacher. Do you remember the teacher? Did the teacher have an effect on you?
Yes. There was a man named Jeffrey Horn, who was an actor, is an actor himself, but he was in the movie The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Uh-huh.
And he was kind of a, you know, a star in the making, mm-hmm. in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a real inspirational guy, because he would... share a lot of his own, like, personal stories.
But did he miss his shot? Was it like that?
A little bit.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit. But, you know, these days I really look up to him just for his... I mean, he's still teaching there.
Is he?
Yeah. He's a...
And what was it that had such an impact on you?
He was... just a very kind guy. He had a very gentle way about him,
mm-hmm.
very gentlemanly way about him. A lot of the other teachers at the school were much more strict, much more... I mean, it was kind of harder to get along with some of them, you know?
How'd you get discovered?
Well, I was pretty fortunate that a casting director... There was a movie called Lost Angels. It's
uh-huh.
kind of a forgotten film, but the pretty big director of that, Hugh Hudson, is a British director.
Uh-huh.
And it was a starring a vehicle for Ad Rock from the Beastie Boys when he was going to
uh-huh.
be an actor.
Uh-huh.
And they went around to all the schools looking for... You know, they wanted new faces. And I got to go in and meet the casting director because of... you know, the notice that she sent to the Strasberg Institute.
Right.
And then they just laid it on me and said, go get it, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's how that happened. I ended up getting cast in that movie. And
how was it?
It was great. I made a lot of I made friends on that project who I'm still friends with, you know,
yeah?
to this day, yeah.
How big was the part?
Not big.
Yeah.
It wasn't big at all, but I did work on it for 3 months.
Yeah.
So there
you
was
were
just,
around.
There was a lot of opportunities just to be around,
uh-huh.
you know.
So you got to know what a set is like, how that works,
all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, you know, we spent some time in San Antonio shooting it, and then they brought us out to LA, and
oh, really?
That was the first time I ever came out here, was to work on that.
That's
movie.
Exciting. And how old were you?
At that point I was 19.
So you finished high school?
Sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, it was hard to stay interested in high school after I started going to the Strasberg Institute.
So did you get... And how'd your parents feel about that?
I think they understood, you know.
So did you graduate or what?
I went to the graduation ceremony, but they didn't give me my diploma.
Yeah.
I hadn't earned it, you know. I still had a lot of credits to make up, and... they said, you can have it if you go to summer school. I'm not doing that.
Who the fuck
just give me my diploma, man. I don't know what if...
Who wants to go to summer school? I had to do that once because I fucked up.
Uh-huh.
It's horrible.
Summer school?
Yeah.
How many times did you have to do that?
One summer. I don't even know if I made it through because I broke my ankle midway through it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how the hell I made it through high school, to be honest with you.
Uh-huh.
I just don't know. Like, I was so distracted, so bored, and just tired and disconnected, and very few things held my attention.
But then you went to Boston University,
yeah.
And you majored in English
yeah.
literature.
Yeah.
So were the roots of that in high school? Were you not interested in
I think my senior year of high school, my mind sort of got blown by some stuff. You know, like I took a poetry class. I started hanging around the university, and I started hanging around this bookstore. You know, and so my mind started to get blown a little bit. You know, in the last couple of years of high school, and I also started to panic. In the last year of high school, that wasn't gonna be, I thought I wasn't gonna go to college. I was like, fuck it. And I was kind of pissed off at my parents and this and that. But the last year of college, I was like, I gotta get out of here. Or the last year of high school, I gotta get out of here. So I locked in.
I
aced it.
Like
I got straight A's the last year. Wasn't enough to get me into a good school because I ended up going to another school the first year. But it wasn't, you know, it proved to me that I could do it, that everyone was right, that I was just not applying myself.
So you applied yourself.
Yeah. The last year. And
did
then
you,
it cut.
Did some part of you feel like, why didn't I do this from the get-go, you know?
I don't know. You know, I've never been good at compartmentalizing learning. You know, like I just take things in it's still hard for me to realize there's a context to everything. Like even an English degree is something I kind of cobbled together. It was not the agenda, you know what I mean? And I took a lot of film classes, film study classes, and art classes, history of photography and stuff. So I was able to sort of get this art history minor, you know, like film crit minor, just because I was interested in things. So I was like, I just wanted to learn some stuff, and then I was able to kind of like, all right, if I do that one and that one, I can major in this thing.
Yeah.
But I was never very good at writing papers or, you know, I was good at bullshitting, but I had a hard time contextualizing things, right? Yeah, everything had, it was very life or death with me, you know. You're never like, you know, this is just how we're learning about the romantic poets. I'm like, no, but these guys are real, you know.
So did you wait till the last minute to do a lot of things?
Yeah, I still do. Still do. You?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a motive, you know, or
gets you in it.
Modus operandi.
Gets you in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, some people really lay stuff out and they prepare and they probably do, you know, I guess in the fields that you and I are in, it's not, no one's saying like, you know, it seemed like you didn't do your work 2 weeks ago. You know, so you're going to show up.
There's that adrenaline that comes with knowing you only have 5 minutes left to do a week's worth of work.
Yeah, and also I think that it's about the being present a bit. I mean, obviously you should get, you know, your ducks in a row if they need to be in a row.
Yeah. No, it helps to be organized.
Yeah.
It helps to be prepared. That was something that Jeffrey Horn always told the students, you know, more than anything other, you know, more than like sense memory or... he just told people to be prepared. You know?
What did that mean?
I think it had several meanings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he would say that you know, he was unprepared for the opportunities that came his way in his youth when he was a young actor because of drinking and stuff like that. But I think it also applies to just the, you know, having a craft, you know, and having a technique.
Sure, get it in place. You know, once you've done it enough, you know, you can kind of rely on it a little bit.
Yeah.
It's not going to leave you hanging.
That's right.
So that sounds like a guy had some regrets, that guy.
I suppose. Maybe not too many.
He's all right?
He's all right, yeah.
Now, when you do, okay, so you do Los Angeles, and then what happens? What? How do you get from there to Goodfellas?
I mean, that was certainly a milestone, and it came a lot earlier than
yeah.
You know, when you're, you know, say you want to be in a rock band, you know,
sure.
It's, you know, if you're getting into that when you're, you know, 42, it's a little too late to expect anything great to happen, right?
Yeah,
you know,
probably.
Because it's a young man's game, right?
Probably.
Even when Bob Dylan was writing his greatest material, arguably, he was 22 years old.
Yeah.
You know, and the moment has to be seized at that age.
Yeah.
You know, and when you, like when I was watching American Graffiti, the reason that the movie had such impact was because of the vitality of these youthful people in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, so you see, you know, Richard Dreyfuss only had one chance to channel all of that energy of that age that he was when he made that film.
How old was he?
I I guess he was in his 20s. Let's say he was in his 20s.
Okay.
You know, so I mean, I'm grateful that, you know, Goodfellas happened when I was 19.
Yeah.
Because it might have been too late if it was any later than that.
You know?
The opportunity wouldn't have come to, you know, the chance to be in Goodfellas only comes around once.
Sure.
You know, and it came around for me, and it was because, the movie that I did with Ad Rock led to
Lost
me getting
Angels.
Lost Angels. I got an agent out of that, and then I started getting auditions, and maybe my third one was for Goodfellas.
Yeah.
I brought that to them. I said, I just read in a magazine that Scorsese's making a movie out of this book, Wise Guy. And so they looked into it, and the first feedback I got from my then agent was that there was nothing in it for me.
Yeah.
And I thought that made no sense because it's a New York story and, you know, this
gotta
is...
Got to be a lot of roles in there.
There did end up being a role that was available. I did go in and read for the casting director, and then she did, you know, say, okay, you can come back to meet Marty tomorrow at the Brill Building. It's like, I'm there. This is happening.
Yeah.
It's happening.
Yeah.
And so I my father helped me with my audition. It was a scene from the movie between Henry Hill and Paulie, right after Henry gets out of jail. And
Reading for who?
I was reading the Henry Hill part.
Was that what you were going in for?
Oh, no. I mean, Ray Liotta already had the part.
Right.
But it was that's the scene that they were giving people
to read.
To,
I get it. Yeah.
You know, it was, two pages long. It wasn't that hard to, you know, there was a sense of urgency about mm-hmm. this appointment. And, you know, I really had to steady myself for walking into that room and seeing him, you know, thinking this is going to go down.
Yeah.
And there he was. He was kind of, he had his back to me when he was looking up at something on the wall, but then he turned around and he was like, oh, how you doing? Come on in. You're in the Lemon Sisters, which was on my resume. It was maybe the second thing I had done. And he goes, they were editing that right downstairs. And I was like, that's cool. Do you know if I'm still in it? He goes, I'll tell you a story about a guy. I had to cut him out of After Hours. Do you remember that guy? It was his first movie. I had to cut him out. It happens. So what are you going to do for us today? I'm like, so then we read the scene. The whole thing went so fast. And by the time it was over, it was just like, he was like, good. That's great.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in. And I couldn't leave. You know, I was sort of stuck in the door frame.
Yeah.
Starting to get really emotional. I said, I got to say that I swore to God I wasn't going to do this. And I can't not do it. I gotta tell you know. And I told, I love you. I love you. I love your movies, and I love you, and I love. It just means so much to me, and you know, I got really kind of. I started to have a meltdown, somewhat internally. Anyway, but he was like, it's great. No. That's good. It's early in the day. I can use that.
Yeah. you're cracking your heart open, and he's
and he was like,
I got to get on with my day a little bit.
Yeah, no, you know, a little flattery and early in the morning is just what he needed.
Yeah,
an hour later, I got hired, which is
and he knew what part he wanted you to be.
Yeah. And I knew what part I was reading for, you know. I knew
but
it was,
that was not the scene you did with him, or
no,
it was?
No,
right.
That wasn't the... Yeah, there was really nothing for the Michael character to read.
Right.
You know? So it was fun stepping into Henry Hill's shoes and pretending I was reading for that.
But more so, it was fun just to be with him, I guess.
Oh, yeah. He's just, you know, he has an energy
that... He invented it. He invented New York cinema in a way.
He did, yeah. I would agree with that. Once I was on the set, it was so just the having so much access to him, which I did. A lot of people who've worked with him have talked, you know, described a different experience from the one I had. But for me, he was always the most approachable person on the set. I mean, that might have had something to do with me being 19 or 20 years old and just being a kid and not knowing any better. I didn't recognize any boundaries.
Uh-huh.
And I was so drawn to him, and I wanted to know things.
Yeah.
I had to know certain things.
Like what?
Like, I had to know what the music was in Mean Streets that comes on after Johnny Boy throws the dynamite off the roof.
Those are the kind of things you need to know.
Yeah, and it was. And I told him, like, can I ask you the Spanish music? That because, oh yeah, that was Ritmo Sabroso by Ray Barreto. I used one of his songs on my first film, Who's That Knocking at My Door?
Uh-huh.
El Watusi. I'll make a tape of it for you. And he did. He sent me to... 2 weeks after I was finished with the job, I got a cassette tape in the mail with a note from his assistant saying, Marty asked me to send this to you. And it had two songs by Ray Barreto on it, El Watusi and Ritmo Sabroso.
Which was the one he used from the Dynamite, the post-Dynamite.
Yes, that dun 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 dun. But for me, that was like Nirvana, getting to... receive that information, you know, because I'm just obsessed with music, and I'm obsessed with his obsession with music,
mm-hmm.
and I feel like he's more than a filmmaker. He's like a DJ, and all the music in his films, as we know, you know, are just so, you know, it's like a perfect marriage between, you know, music and cinema.
Goodfellas is a masterpiece.
Oh, just, you know, minute after every, from wall to wall.
I watch it all the time. I mean, I watch it at least twice a year, I think.
Yeah, that's...
Do you?
That's about my average. maybe once a year, but it's...
I watch Casino once a year, but Goodfellas twice, probably.
Yeah, I'm with you. I ran into Ray Liotta a couple of years ago out here for an event at the Bel Air Hotel.
Yeah.
It was a cocktail reception for Hugo.
Right.
So everyone showed up for this thing who'd ever been in a Scorsese film. You know, I said, "You remember me? I played your brother in Goodfellas." He goes, "Yeah. How's it going?" I'm like, "Good, great. You know, you were really great in that movie."
Goodfellas.
I haven't seen it, even because we hadn't seen each other since we were on the set, and yeah. it's like, it's crazy. It's like so long ago. It's a classic now. You know, it's a classic, right? Because he said he never watched it after
that in an interview or something.
No, I asked him. I said, "Do you watch Goodfellas?" He goes, "I've only seen it once.
Yeah,
I saw the premiere. That was it." Like, really? Wow, I feel stupid. I've seen it like 100 times. You know.
Yeah.
Most people
have seen it.
Do watch it a lot, and you've only seen Ray Liotta's only seen Goodfellas once.
Why do you think? Did you ask him why?
I don't think he's that interested, you know, in looking at himself. You know, like he doesn't seem to. I don't know if there is a movie that he, you know, that he's so. I don't know if he's the kind of guy who gets that sentimental about. Movies.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Like, when you do, how often do you watch some other movies? Been in, you know, dozens of movies.
Oh, I like to. I know just how he feels. You know.
Sure, but that movie's a masterpiece. That thing's a.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it works.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's kind of like it's foolproof. You know, you can't not watch it.
Yeah.
It's just so masterfully put together.
Do you feel good about your work in that movie?
Not really, no. But
do you think that you watch and go like, yeah, I could have said I'm stirring it differently?
Kind of, you know, or I could have changed the line, or I could have, but I was so, you know, on my best behavior,
uh-huh.
which can be the worst, you know, approach.
Well, that was your first big movie.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't feel there wasn't a whole lot of excitement in my work in that film. I was having too much fun in between takes talking to
Marty.
To Marty.
And what else did you ask him? What were the other compulsive sort of like needs that needed to be like?
Like I said, when did Mean Streets take place? And he goes, it takes place in the early 60s. I'm like, okay, because it came out in the early 70s, and no one ever says when it is. And he goes, yeah, no, it is the early 60s.
Huh.
And I was like, that's because that makes so much sense to me
right.
Now.
Yeah, yeah. Because everyone associates it with the 70s.
Yeah, you know, like there's even a line in the movie where one of the Carradine brothers is like a Vietnam veteran, and you know, David Proval, the guy starts to freak out and goes, hey, "Jerry, you're back in America now. You're back in America."
So is that Bobby Carradine? Who was it? He's too young. Which wasn't David? Was it Keith? Keith, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's the one who's like, I have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, yeah.
And Keitel goes, so go ahead. What do you want me to hold it for you?
Yeah.
But just all the minutia of the film, like I just wanted to I was always going up to sneaking up behind him, you know. Yeah. What is this? Yeah, another question about me? What do you like? I'm sorry. He goes, I'm only kidding. I'm looking. What do you want to know? And I was like, tell me, you know, I was just always feeding off of. But he's so, you know, he's so game, or he was for me. I don't know. He indulged me. He really did.
He's probably happy to have you on the set. Someone who was that excited about it, young guy.
Yeah. I guess.
Did you have any contact with him after before? Like, well, you were in The Departed too, right?
Yeah. That it was. You know, I had the privilege of being in two of his. You know, getting to do that twice.
Did you pester him again?
Yeah. Yeah, it was like not a day had gone by. I was 16 years older.
Yeah,
and I felt just like that kid again. And I said, so Marty, did you Cream is getting back together? He goes, I know. I was going to go to that show, but I couldn't. I was in pre-production for this, and I said, so yeah. So hey, listen, let me ask you something. I know. Sajat Ray, the
Indian director.
You know, when I said there was a scene in one of his movies where there's all these Indian musicians playing bagpipes, they're wearing kilts, and he's like, yeah, that was the Apu trilogy. That, you know, he remembered the scene exactly, and I was like, well, what's up with that? I mean, you know, like that drone, that bagpipe drone, and the sitar kind of thing. Yeah. You know, I mean, every culture, you know, discovers that. At some point or another, they sort of have a, you know, they find that if they take a stomach lining of an animal, dry it out, and a couple of months go by, and then they hit it, and it goes, boom, oh, they're like, oh, wow. That happens in every culture over the centuries.
That wasn't even the question you were asking, really.
Yeah, no, it was just, we worked ourselves up into a, he gets very, you know, often, you know, the first AD would have to come over and break it up.
Oh, really? Because you were just going?
He's like, we're ready to go here. The shot's all set up. But he was, you know, I asked him about, I know, everybody knows you're a Rolling Stones guy, but what are you thinking of Beatles? He goes, I love the Beatles. I, you know, I've just never been able to use any of their music in my films, but he ended up using the John Lennon song in that movie.
You like Leonardo? You guys friends?
Yeah, I had fun working with him. We had a good time. Yeah. Although I did have to break the ice.
Yeah.
You know, I met him on an airplane right before he went to work on Gangs of New York.
Uh-huh.
And we had a mutual friend, Michael Rappaport.
Yeah.
So that's how I
started.
How's
he doing?
Michael's doing pretty good. He's great on an episode of Louis.
Yeah. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. I just finally caught up with that. Watched that a week ago. He was tremendous in that. He's doing okay. But yeah, I like Leo. He's a sweet guy. He was. I drew him out. I got him to talk about some stuff, and it was kind of interesting, you know.
Yeah, I think you should do a movie of just like you and Marty Scorsese. But yeah, he has to be doing other things.
I would do it if he would act in the movie. Like, I would love to see a Scorsese movie where he was the star of the movie.
Yeah,
I mean, I think he's a really underrated actor.
Well, based on the cab scene in Taxi Driver?
That, and also he had a part in that movie Guilty by Suspicion.
Oh, yeah.
He played Van Gogh in a Kurosawa film called Dreams.
He also had a little moment in King of Comedy as the...
As the director.
The director, the TV director. It's funny.
Yeah, and he played an agent in the Dexter Gordon movie, Round Midnight.
Uh-huh.
He's a great actor.
Yeah.
And he's really funny. He's like one of the funniest people you could ever meet. He's just so... It's like he should be a stand-up comic. He's like Gilbert Gottfried or something.
Uh-huh.
He's just... So
character. Do you talk to him outside of socially in any way?
No, never. I never. I the last time I saw him was at that thing for
Hugo.
Uh-huh. I was, you know, sort of competing for, you know, the next moment with Marty. From everybody wanted to talk to him. It was like the State of the Union address where the president can't leave the building without shaking 2,000 hands.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Having a moment with each and every one of these people. And I remember Franny Leibowitz and I were looking at each other like, as if to say, I'm next.
Yeah.
It's like, you, no, yeah, well, you he made a movie about you, you a documentary film about you. But when I finally got to talk to him,
yeah,
at that event, I was telling him how much I enjoyed living in the material world, the George Harrison documentary. I said, that's just fabulous. What a great movie that was. I think you really nailed it with that movie. And he's like, yep, that's the one. And he moved on. And I couldn't tell whether he was like, you should be saying about my current film. That's my last one. But
that was a documentary you did about George Harrison?
Yes.
I didn't see it.
You know, leave it to him to make the best Beatle movie, you know?
Hmm. I think I saw that he did a Dylan movie.
He did, yeah.
Where I watched that.
No Direction Home. Yeah. I loved when he was on I forget what talk show, Charlie Rose or something, and they were asking, they asked him, like, what's the significance of the title, No Direction Home? What do you think it is? It's a song, right?
Yeah.
But the way he put it, well, you know, No Direction Home, just, it's like we're constantly looking for a home as artists, as people, as just living our life, you know, we're always looking for home, you know, and I think we finally find it when we die.
That's it.
And then we're finally home.
How did Charlie handle that?
In his usual way. You
feel
know?
That question. I know that that you did this, you did Grounded for Life forever. For that was a long time, right?
Yeah, that was a while back. It's resurfaced now on Netflix. So
yeah, so people are
hearing about it again. Yeah, yeah.
That was a big job, though. Do you like working in TV, too?
Yeah, I did. I did enjoy it, yeah. You know, it's just, I'd been on a show with Malcolm McDowell in 97 or something. It was a multi-camera mm-hmm. show, and I didn't have... that whole way of working was so new to me at the time, and I didn't have a lot of fun, and I never thought I would go back to doing that again. But then Grounded for Life came along, and, you know, that was kind of a 50-50 experience. But Donal was there, and I don't know if you know Donal Logue, but he's a great guy. I would have lost my mind if it weren't for him. He was very...
How's he doing?
I think he's doing pretty good. He's got so many things going on. He's on that show Gotham. Is that still on?
I don't know what's on television.
Sons of Anarchy, you know.
Yeah, he always seems to be working. He's like you. You guys always seem to be working.
Yeah, sort of journeyman actors.
Well, how come... what about music then? You know, I mean, you seem like a freak for it, and you play some. I know I just downloaded the album that you did with Crystal Robots Band.
Yeah, that guy, it's mainly, all the music in that project is written by a guy from New York named Daniel Harnett.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a band in the like early mid-90s called Glim, and they had a residency at a club on St. Mark's Place called Chenet. And actually, Jeff Buckley made his New York debut sitting in with them. With Glim. And Daniel and Jeff kind of rubbed off on each other. Daniel has a very impressive vocal range, you know, and he's a prolific songwriter. You know, I mean, he's just I've never heard one that I didn't like. I sort of met him more through the acting circles, but I became a real fan of his music. And I began archiving it. I mean, he just has like 1,000 songs.
Wow.
And
do you have a label?
No, it's just us, you know, self-released. I started to say you should turn these cassette demos into full songs, like full studio production. So I threw myself into, you know, making a real album with him. And so we've done 2 so far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of threw myself into the role of, you know, pseudo manager / producer, you know, mm-hmm. not knowing anything about either of those mm-hmm. things, but figuring that never stopped Brian Epstein.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. So you're sitting on a real gold mine, huh?
Yeah. I was like, you know, someone should, because he's like, you know, Daniel is a bit like the character Oscar Isaac plays in Inside Llewyn Davis, uh-huh. you know, and he's, you know, I've taken Daniel with me to see Bob Dylan twice because uh-huh. I just wanted to be in the same room with the two of them. to say I did it, you know.
How long ago did you see Dylan?
I saw him last November at the Beacon Theater.
How was he?
He was great. I think he's great, you know.
It's hilarious to me that he released that Sinatra record.
Yeah.
And like, you know, for the last decade, he's been playing live and undecipherable in some terms. And now like he puts a record out where he clearly can still sing. And he can clearly, you know, deliver phrasing.
Yeah.
It's just that for, he just apparently gets on stage and it's like, how do you see him and not be like, is that a big fuck you? Is that a decade of like, you want this shit? Well, I'm going to garble through it.
Yeah, he thinks of himself as a, well, it's like he said in that old film, I'm a song and dance man.
No, I get that.
He's an actor, you know, and he's just found a new script to play with, the Sinatra songbook, you know, and he has a wonderful voice. The last song of the evening was, you know, like nothing else. The rest of the show, he came out and played, you know, I don't know, Strangers in the Night or something, and sat at the piano and crooned, and it was like, who knew that Dylan could sing like that? And sure enough, he had a whole album on the way of material like that. It's, yeah, you know, it's I think it's a little hit and miss. Some songs would come off better than others, but just that he wants to do that his creative appetite led him in that direction.
I just think it's hilarious that, like, you know, you could see him some nights and not know what fucking song he's playing or singing.
Yeah,
and yet he can still do it.
Yeah, no,
it's a choice.
Yeah, sure. It's. I went to see him a year before the Beacon show at the Mohegan Sun Arena. We drove up there, and you know, I thought that was going to be a bust because it was a casino, and yeah, it was just like
I've been up there. For those type of casinos, it's a pretty nice place.
Yeah, yeah. That ended up being a great show. There was a little, it took him about five or six songs to get into a groove.
Uh-huh.
He looked really frustrated after the end of every tune with his band.
Really?
He just kept kicking his piano chair away and
really?
Then coming back and starting the next song. And but then something happened around the sixth tune. It was called the tune Not Dark Yet, But Getting There. From Time Out of Mind
Time
or something
Out of Mind,
like that.
Yeah.
There was something that just settled in.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of found their moment. He's like a method actor, you know, in that way.
Who else do you go see?
I've seen some pretty cool shows over the years. I've gone to see people that I really wanted to see. Like, I saw Ravi Shankar twice.
Really?
Once at Carnegie Hall in 98, and I saw him at UCLA in 2000.
Just sitting there with his sitar?
And his daughter, you know, plays the sitar as well. The Carnegie Hall show was just tremendous, you know. I mean, they take that, you know, first half hour tuning up.
Yeah.
They always get applause for tuning up.
Really?
I've never seen
the sitar show.
Yeah, it's purely improvisational. So, I mean,
I used to do a joke about it. It was one of my favorite jokes. About, like, the setup of the joke was, you know, out of protest for, you know, I went out and bought an album by a band. I don't remember what the reference was. I didn't even want to buy it. I just got bullied into it by listening to the radio. You know, I didn't really, and it bothered me that I'd been hijacked like that. Yeah. So I went and returned that CD, and I got a CD of traditional Indian music. And I said, yeah, okay, you can judge me, you can laugh, but there's a song on there, half an hour long. And I said, it takes 10 minutes for the drums to kick in. But then I said, but if you're really listening, they couldn't come in a second sooner.
You know what was great? During the show, I saw he actually broke a string.
Oh, no shit. Aren't there, like, how many strings on a sitar? There's a lot, right?
Yes, I don't know how many, but there's a lot. Right? It's kind of a big deal to break a string on a sitar. Uh-huh. You know, it took a while to replace it, but in the meantime, he let the tabla player have a solo.
Sure, man.
And that was tremendous. Whoever that guy was.
Yeah.
It was remarkable.
Someone knows who he is.
Yeah, someone out there knows what.
Right now, you mentioned that. Oh, he's talking about David's Indian. Yeah,
I remember he looked a little bit like Donovan. You know?
Oh yeah, white guy.
Yeah. He looked.
I love to see. I saw a white sitar player once at a small Indian restaurant, like on Sixth Street. It's a white guy, older guy. He must have been like 30 or 40. And I remember I said, it's got to be a lot of troubling calls home. You know, you're like, you're like, yeah, I got another gig, Ma. I was at a different Indian restaurant. It's a different... It's heartbreaking, but I seem to be enjoying himself.
Yeah, you gotta commit. You gotta love it. You gotta want it.
Do you play guitar?
Yeah. I
do a little in the movie. Results, you noodling around.
Yeah.
Did they tell you like don't play anything we can identify?
I think yeah, there was a little bit of that. Yeah, they did say that. Yeah. Now I'm remembering. Yeah. I was 13 when I sort of went and decided I wanted a guitar. But, you know, my parents were like, look, the acting thing is one thing, all right? Giving you a year to figure that out. We're not getting you a guitar.
Really?
So, they didn't put it in those words, but it was, I just never got one.
Until
I was 19, and then I had my own means of...
You had to wait?
6 years, and then I finally got like an acoustic guitar.
Yeah,
it was a BC Rich.
A BC Rich acoustic.
Yeah.
Huh.
A friend of mine out in Astoria said, "I got a guitar I could sell you if you really want, you know." And that guitar went around. It changed hands over the years.
Yeah, there's a few of mine are out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long have you been playing?
That was like 12.
Wow.
11 or 12.
Who did you want to be? Who did you want to sound like? Or who was...
I think I've gotten better in the last 5 or 6 years. Like, I never had the discipline to learn leads or stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and like, for years I just played. My mother just would say, go practice. And I just knew chords and stuff. And then... When I was in high school, I started taking lessons from a guy who showed me pentatonic scales. And I just wanted to sound like, I just wanted to know how to play that Chuck Berry thing, that Chuck Berry beginning. You know, and some kid showed me that in high school, and I was like, oh my God, that's the best thing I've ever experienced in my life, was knowing how to play that. Yeah. But I could have figured it out. I just never took much time to figure it out. And then, I just never stopped playing, really. But now, like, I play a lot, and I try to play with people, and I don't know the sound I like now is like, you know, these pedal people, Earthquaker sends me all these pedals because they sponsor sometimes, right? And that was always anti-pedals. I like just overdriving an amp, mm-hmm. like a little Fender amp, and just getting that dirty sound out of it. I used to be a Fender guy, just clean as fuck. Mm-hmm. Strat, clean Tele, not much dirt on it. But then I start playing this little Gibson Les Paul Jr. and sound like Johnny Thunders. And I'm like, is that easy to make this guitar sound like that? All I got to do is dirty this up, and that's a Johnny Thunders guitar?
Yeah.
And I was like, that's pretty cool. So then I start getting into Gibsons a little bit.
Oh, no.
You know, and I like a, I like dirty, like, but still just with pretty basic tube overdrive, not too many effects.
Yeah.
I'm not a great player, but when I play, I tend to play rock and blues, mm-hmm. and some country stuff. And, you know, but I don't play out a lot, but I'll noodle all the time. What about you?
When I play guitar, I've had a handful of buddies over the years who play drums.
Uh-huh.
And we just get together at a Funkadelic or, you know, a cheap, you know,
studio
yeah. and just jam for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Improvising on just guitar and drums, so it comes out like real punk. There's a sort of metal kind of muted chords and just grooves, you know. I can't lick either, I can't solo, but I love rhythms and I love drones and I love
you like Endless Boogie,
the John Lee Hooker.
No,
yeah.
No, the band, you ever heard of?
Oh, Endless? No,
you don't know them?
Don't know them.
It's an old dude from the island, from Long Island, I think. They're from Long Island.
Oh, all right.
And it's like, it's just sort of like swampy kind of hard rock groove.
Oh, wow.
I'll play it for you in a minute if you want.
Yeah, I would love that. I love that style. I love, you know, I love like, I guess a so-called sort of punk blues
uh-huh.
sound John Spencer Blues yeah. Explosion.
He's good, yeah.
Or there was that band... Gun Club.
Sure, I love them. Jeffrey Lee.
Yeah. That I like that sound a lot.
That's great sound.
Yeah.
Sure, man.
I like Black Sabbath a lot.
Glad, me too.
You know, when I got
it took late. I didn't come to them till later.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, like within the last decade, I was already in my 40s.
Oh.
Like, I didn't grow up liking them.
Mm-hmm.
But now, like, Sabbath sounds good. Those records sound good. Yeah.
Yeah, on vinyl, sure. At the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. It's just like sort of... My friend George and I, the guy in Astoria, sometimes we get together and to cleanse the palate.
Sure, man.
We'll put on, Symptom of the Universe, or what's that other song?
Confusion.
I think it's track 3 on Sabotage.
Yeah. Okay.
What the hell is it?
I don't know, man.
it just starts out with it. But
you play it on vinyl?
No, over at his place, we just listen to it.
You know, I do
computer.
That too, man. Me and my buddy. I used to when I was in college, my freshman year of college. Me and this kid from Scarsdale, actually, Cliff. We used to do this thing called the AC/DC cruise, where I had a tape, this mixtape of Bon Scott AC/DC, and we just get a couple of 40s and get in the car, and we drive until we finish the 40s listening to AC/DC. Just nice. Loud.
I'm a purist when it comes to like Sabbath and AC/DC. I really can't go past the original singer.
Yeah, me too. I'm even weird with the Stones. I have a hard time without Bill. I just don't. But like you too.
I'm with you.
Huh.
I love his bass playing.
Oh,
you know,
best.
No one ever raves about Bill Wyman's bass playing.
You know what you got to do? Abco just reissued Get Your Ya-Ya's Out. Listen to that fucking record.
Yeah.
Bill and Charlie are on fire. The entire thing would be chaos without him. Just like, it was, I never really noticed it as clear, but this they're remastered a little, so they're a little more prominent. And it's just like Mick Taylor's great, Keith is great, but like those guys are just like, it's all about them.
Yeah.
It's all about Charlie and Bill.
Yeah, and they're all business, you know?
All business.
You know, I love John Lennon when he's talking about, you know, what Mick Jagger, you know, shaking his ass around, you know, not Bill, not Charlie. Those guys got to hold it down so Mick can indulge, so those other guys can...
Well, Keith's like that too. Keith is like... You know, I talked to them both for 10 minutes. Yeah.
Keith and
Mick. They called me two separate times. But I only had 10 minutes, and it was tour specific. But, you know, I talked to them, you know. And it was like, did you read Keith's book?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. It's like the Bible, right? You read it like the Bible. I don't want this to end, you know. And then, but, you know, because I asked them both the question. I asked Mick, you know, do you miss Bill? And he goes, I miss his dancing, which is funny. Funny, it's clever. Yeah. Right. And then I asked Keith the same question. He goes, oh, it's been like 25 years. I mean, he's a good bloke, but I mean, I like my baseball. He wouldn't throw the new guy under the bus because Keith just sees it as a band. Like, it's his band. Mm-hmm. Like, and when you read his book, you're like, it's his band and mm-hmm. Mick is his singer. That's the way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was a very appropriate answer, very within in character. Like, I like my bass player. Like, if you really think of that band, you know, who's come in and out and, you know, this, you know, and supporting players. But I mean, they've had three fucking guitar players,
mm-hmm.
right? Brian, Ronnie, Mick, Taylor.
Yeah.
So, like, there is sort of a evolution to it.
Yeah.
And the supporting players have come and gone, mm-hmm. many of them.
I wonder, it's like, you know, the maybe you would ask maybe Paul McCartney the same thing, like, how come you don't have Ringo in there playing drums? He's still playing drums, you know, you can get him in there to play. He's happy with the guy he has now, you know? It's like, once you get an upgrade, you know?
I guess it's an upgrade because they end up playing like the other guy anyways. You know, like,
right.
You know, but they're more versatile, I guess. I don't know, but you know, it's weird. I don't understand it. Like, you know, it's weird to me too. Even like you saying that, you know, you never see Ray Liotta or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like I always assume these guys are such good friends. But you know, I worked with a guy on the radio for a year once, and we never hung out. And it's like, you know, I guess it's just a weird thing.
Yeah.
Who the fuck knows?
Right. Yeah.
They're not all having a good time. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. Someone sent me a picture of Woody Allen, recent picture.
Yeah.
He's just looks, I'm like, do you think he's as unhappy as he looks in this picture? It's like, who knows, you know? Should he be? What's it to you? You know, yeah, it's like, we would like to think that, you know, all these guys are still, you're right. They're probably not that close.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. Because I said that. I said, you know, Keith was very funny to talk to me for 10 minutes because they're doing this tour. And this was like a month ago. You know, the tour is a month out. I said, you talked to Charlie Watts? He goes, yeah, I talked to him today. I asked him what he was doing. He said he was packing. Yeah, it's pretty funny, dude. So this new movie, you like it?
Yeah, I do. I like it.
It seems pretty quirky and interesting. I'm looking forward to finishing it.
Yeah. I like all of this guy's movies. This is his fifth one. And probably his most visible one.
Yeah. God, you've been in a lot of fucking movies, dude.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot to do in most of them, but when you see all those titles, it's kind of like
you were good with Patton in the thing.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. I was a big fan of Patton Oswalt before working on that movie with him. When I got that script, I read it, and they had offered me the part of the friend, and I said, I kind of like the lead part.
Yeah.
And Robert, the director, said, yeah, you'd be good, and you'd be good at that, but I cast it already. So I don't know if you... I was like, yeah, I'm always the friend, you know. I don't really know if I don't know.
Are you frustrated with that?
No, not well. When he told me that it was going to be Patton as the lead guy, I was like, oh, well, I'll be his friend.
Yeah, but it's interesting. You have had a career of sort of a second parts and
the perennial second banana.
Yeah, but do you want to make movies? Did you direct movies?
I directed or co-directed. I'm really coming around to the admission that I didn't direct this thing. The other guy did, but he was gracious enough to take we credited ourselves as co-directors, but he really did everything. Uh-huh. And it was a low budget kind of period piece based on a short story by a guy from the 50s named John McNulty, and he just wrote about drinking and about bars on Third Avenue. He was a real kind of East Side Manhattan guy. He wrote stories for the New Yorker. Mm-hmm. He wrote about like horse betters and cabbies and drinkers. It was the easiest way to go was to just like adapt this one story by him about two guys in a bar.
What was it called?
It's called Two People He Never Saw.
Uh-huh.
It's on the internet. It's me and an actor named Nick Sandow, who's on Orange is the New Black.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty long for a short film. It's about 25 minutes long. But we shot it in this old bar in Brooklyn. I thought we kind of got at something with it. It's kind of hard to adapt that guy's material, but I take credit for it. I take the blame for it, you know.
Good. Is something you want to do more of?
I do. I want to have another go at one of that guy's stories. I want to make like a kind of a 40s movie.
What part are you looking for, really, in your mind? Because we started off the conversation by, you talking about those organic performances of younger actors, but also like being moved by terms of endearment. It really seemed to have a specific sort of feel to you, the role. You're always looking for that right role. What would you like to do?
I'm not sure.
You'll know it when you see it.
Well, I did kind of... there's a part I played on this show that's coming up on TNT in August called Public Morals, and that's a period piece. It's set in 1967. It's about the NYPD, the Public Morals Division of the NYPD in the mid to late 60s, and the relationship between the Irish gangster underworld and the police department.
Well, that sounds cool.
I got to play a character in that named Smitty, who's a bookie, and I felt like I was doing what I wanted to do in that. Tapping into something. I mean, I love James Cagney and I love the old days, and this kind of got in, we got into that a bit. You know?
And that's not quite the 40s, but it's, you know, going it's, back.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
It's a
I'm
guy.
I'm still digging my way back.
Oh, that's great. Well, I hope you get there.
I'm good at digging holes. Getting out of them, it's going to be another story.
And how are your parents enjoying the...
Good. They're
proud. They like you.
Sure. They get something out of it.
It takes a while, doesn't it? It takes a while for them to come. Like my mother's now sort of like, I saw you on the deal. Like now I can genuinely hear that she thinks I've done something.
She's just coming to that.
Last few years, yeah.
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 Well, that must be gratifying. You know, better late than never. Do you feel that way about it? Or
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes. It's nice. It's nice.
Does she understand exactly what you're doing?
Yes. Yeah. She listens to the podcast all the time. She claims it's the only way she can know what I'm up to.
And be with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's good. We both get along with our parents.
Yeah, it's so boring.
Is it? No, this is great, man. It was good talking to you. You feel good about it?
Yeah.
We picked up pace.
Yeah.
There was a moment of panic there where you're like, this is going nowhere.
No, I did. I did feel that way. I still feel that way. But, you know, I'm always going to feel that way, you know?
Was there anything that you'd like to... one last thing we need to do?
No, I had my shot.
All right, I'll talk to you later. That was, I love that guy. He's a great guy. Like I said, I love that movie. I really enjoyed that movie. And now I'm going to, now that this is an eternal show between me talking about the Stones, it's not going to stop me from noodling. I have nothing planned here. Boomer lives!